As I mentioned, this is the last week that we are discussing kashrus, and I guess a very fitting way of ending these two volumes on kashrus is now that we've discussed the requirements of separating milk and dairy and the issues related to food cooked by non-Jews and kashering utensils and toveling utensils and everything that comes with that and wine. So the big question that comes up then, so how do I know at the end of the day that these laws are being followed? Okay, because when it comes to kosher, so it's not like, you know, you buy, you buy a shofar or lulav from people who are presumed to be experts, but kosher is obviously something, you know, everybody makes food, whether it's, you know, family and friends that we eat at or whether it's things we buy from stores. But there's so many intricacies of kosher and there's also so much of a business around it. So how do we really know that what we're having is proper, and how can I assume that it's permissible for me to have? So that's the essential question for us to address to tonight. I think as I started doing the last couple of times, I'm going to try to stop at different section points. So unless there's something that's sort of immediately unclear, if there are any sort of further probing questions, I'll stop at a couple of various points for that. We're on page 313. And I guess before we begin, one thing that one term that I should define is the word for trustworthiness or believability in Hebrew is ne'amanut or ne'amanus. Somebody who is ne'aman is somebody who can be believed, who can be trusted. And ne'amanus is the word that we use to refer to somebody whose trustworthiness has been established. I'm just muting people for sound purposes, but of course I'll mute if you have something to say. So the first principle that we have to establish is there's a principle in halacha that eid echa ne'man be'isurin, that one witness is believed when it comes to matters of prohibition. So when it comes to things that are, let's say, things related to the judicial system, when there's a testimony related to monetary matters or even criminal matters. So obviously we're familiar with the fact that you need two witnesses, and we have two witnesses. I was at a wedding last night. There's two witnesses for the ksuba. There's two witnesses for kiddushin. There's two witnesses for tanaim. So we're talking about something that's not something that's brought before a beis din, but we're talking about just sort of everyday life. But how do we navigate things that are permitted or prohibited? So the principle is eid echa ne'man be'isuin. So in source one, the Gemara in Gintin says, "Emor demrinan eid echa ne'man be'isuin." So one can say that we say one witness is deemed credible with regard to prohibitions. Kigon chaticha safek shel shuman. So if I'm not sure if a certain piece of meat is just regular permitted fat or whether it's a prohibited fat. So in that case, we assume that one person is believed, because there's no presumption that it's forbidden. In other words, if I have a regular piece of meat, and again, I'm assuming that it's coming from a regular piece of meat, so we don't necessarily know one way or another that it's prohibited. We don't have reason to assume that it's prohibited. So as long as one person can say, I know factually that this piece is kosher, so then we can believe that individual. The Rashi explains that Sharei Mina Torah kol echad echad Yisrael al afrashas truma v'ashchita v'nikor ha'gid v'achil. So the Torah believes one if when it comes to separating truma or it comes to shchita. So we don't say that you have to have two outside witnesses that are supervising shchita. As long as the shochet says that he did the shchita, so we assume that he did the shchita, and that's considered to be sufficient. Of course, the individual who's that aid, obviously they themselves have to be trustworthy. But assuming that we'll get to cases where we're not necessarily sure if the person's trustworthy, but assuming that an average Jew is doing the right thing, we assume that their shchita is good. We assume that they separate truma if they said they did so, and that should apply to kashrus. And in another place in Shas, Rashi explains, this is source 3 on page 314, the reason why Eid Echa Ne'eman B'Yisurin applies with kashrus, let's say, is that if we didn't hold by this principle, So nobody could ever eat by anybody else. Nobody will ever eat each other's food because otherwise, from a formal halachic perspective, if I can't establish the fact that that I can believe somebody when they say something's kosher, that by definition means that, unless you have some sort of absurd chain of people who are watching every little move, so how could anybody possibly eat anybody else's food? So, Eid Echad Naaman Bisur. So Rashi gives a sort of logical explanation there that the reason why this is because society can't function otherwise in many of these areas of halacha. Tosfos give an actual scriptural source for this in source four, and they learn this out from Nida, really from the concept of Zava, but nowadays from Nida. So the Torah says that when a woman is a Zava, or nowadays when she's a Nida, so she has to count 7 clean days from the end of her period. So the Torah says, V'safra Allah. It doesn't just say V'safra Shivas Yamim. It says V'safra Allah Shivas Yamim, which means that, so which saying, and she counts for herself. The fact that she could count for herself means that a woman is able to count for herself that those 7 clean days. So in other words, she doesn't have to submit any sort of a report to anybody or whatnot. But and it goes the other way as well, right? The moment that a woman really becomes nida in terms of either tuma issues, which are not relevant nowadays, or in terms of her relationship with her husband, so she becomes nida when she says that she's man. That's her ability to establish that status, and likewise to say that she's emerged from the Nida status. That's something that woman establishes from herself. So Tosfos will then say, so we said, and the Gemara had said that one person is believed when it's not that there's already sort of a prohibition that's in place. But when it comes to Anita, so once she's Anita, so her status is one of Isur. So therefore Tosfos says, so number one, so a period is something that only happens for a specific amount of time, but it's obviously not a status that's continual. So it's not a continual status of prohibition, and so from there we can understand that if she says that it started and it stopped, so we understand that. So the 7 days pass, the bleeding obviously stops at some point, and also at some point she has the ability to go to the mikvah. So she has the ability to change that status. So based on this, Maharsha says that there's really sort of two principles here that either has to be, this is elaborating source five, but just to sort of summarize what he says here is that either it's itchazik isura, but biyado to change it. So either there's prohibited status, but it has the ability to be changed, or it's not, or even if there's not an ability to change it, but it's not a status that's assumed to be prohibited. So let's say when the woman becomes Anita, so she's Becheskas Isura, but the bleeding will stop anyway. So the status will change to like so she can't be Tova at that point, but the status will change. Or and then once she has the ability to be to Tova, even if she's still technically Anita. So she has that ability. So those are sort of the operating principles here that we're concerned that either that there shouldn't be a presumed prohibition or presumed status here, and or the fact that it can be changed. Raman goes as far as to say in source seven, even when there is prohibition that's established, one has the ability to believe when it comes to Yisurin. So, the way this comes out in Shulchan Aruch, in source 8, so, and this is brought up specifically with the laws of Yain Nesef, with the laws of wine for Avodah Zarah that we were discussing in the last couple of weeks. So he says in source eight, in source eight, eid acha neman bisurim lahatir v'lahachmir. So a witness can be believed when it comes to matters of prohibition with regard to food, but that's only to be lenient, not necessarily to be stringent. So Rama says, comes and says that if there's a clear proof that something is prohibited, so eid acha neman bisurim, there also, if it's clear that something is prohibited, so then of course one person can be and prohibited. But he ends off by saying, but a person is believed about his own food even where there has been established as being in a state of prohibition. So when someone's own food, he can he or she can testify, so to speak, not testify, but can demonstrate that it's permitted and that is sufficient. They don't need any sort of outside corroboration. With that said, there's a Gemara that might seem to contradict that. On page 318, source 9, Gemara in Beitza, it says Rapapi was visiting Mar Shmuel on Yantif. And he was brought porridge, which is the way porridge is made, is that you have to grind the wheat groats and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he wouldn't eat it. The concern there was that maybe it was that the porridge, the wheat for the porridge was ground on Yantif itself. So when it comes to food on Yantif, so technically speaking, anything that's ochal nefesh is permitted on Yantif. If it's anything, the cooking process is permitted to be done on Yantif, but only if it's being done sort of in small quantities. It can't be that like you went out to the field and you picked everything and did like a whole harvest. There has to be things that are already sort of like kind of accessible at home and being done on a very small scale only for Yantif. So the Gemara says, well, maybe it was done with a small mortar and pestle. It was done just for Yantif. But he said that it was well ground and has to be that was done on a greater scale. So how do we know that wasn't done before? Well, because he saw that the husks were bright, which means that they had been done really recently. So why is it that Rapapi was suspicious? So Shani Bey Mar Shmuel, the Ika Pritzuta da Avde. Mar Shmuel had a servant, and the servants maybe weren't so careful about Hilchos Yom Tov. So from this, the Shita Bekubetz and Pisvei Tshuva explain that the only reason why Rapapi was strict was because there was actually a reason to be suspicious, because the people who were working for Mar Shmuel were lax. But Pesach Tshuva in source 11 says, "It echa neman bisurin in tzarich lachkor ich nas ebeheter." You don't have to do a whole exploration of how it was done. We assume that everything was done properly. And Chita Mekubetzit in the previous source says that we learned from the story that we should not presume the existence of a prohibition, as all Jews are presumed to be trustworthy, as the reason given here why Rav Papa did not eat the food was due to the laxity of the slaves. So, just threw sort of a lot out here, and there's been a lot of this analysis going on here, but the essential point that emerges from this discussion is, generally speaking, Eid Echa Neman Bisurin, if a Jew who is, you know, don't have any reasons to be concerned about their trustworthiness, so they say something's kosher, so we assume that it's kosher, that they have the ability to do that. As Rashi explained, it's the only way that we're able to eat from each other. But more than that, especially when we're talking about just like regular food, so we don't have to, if we don't have any reason to assume that that food is prohibited, so... so then we are in a situation where it is fine. Any questions up to this point? Comments? Okay. So where things get a little bit more tricky is when it comes to relying on the kashrut of non-observant Jews. In a world where everybody around you keeps kosher, so again, this could be the end of the shiur is not really much to talk about. We live in a little bit more of a complicated world, and that was even true with Chazal, that there were certain situations that Chazal had concerns for themselves also, even if people were nominally observing. We'll see in a second. So now we have to figure out, so what are the parameters, what are the limits of assuming that whenever somebody says that it's kosher, that it's kosher. Mishnah and Demine, now this is source 12 on page 319, says, Hamakaba alav, somebody who wants to have the status of being trustworthy for Talmid Chachamim, among Torah scholars, they want to be considered to be trustworthy. They're not allowed to eat with an Am Ha'aretz. So there's different definitions in Shas of what Am Ha'aretz is, different context. People often use it just as a way of jabbing at somebody who doesn't know a lot, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. Maran Brachos gives all sorts of definitions. You know, somebody who a man who doesn't put on tefillin every day, or doesn't say Shema every day, is an Am Ha'aretz. That's a fairly low bar. Here we're talking about the concern of demai. So we know that truma has to be taken, tithes have to be taken for a truma. A demai is when we're not sure if the truma has been taken. And the concern was that Ami Ha'aretz were not careful about demai. So somebody who's a chaver, somebody who's a Talmid Chacham, wouldn't be allowed to eat with an Am Ha'aretz. Rabbi Yehuda says that you are allowed to eat with an Am Ha'aretz. You can be trustworthy even if you dine with an Am Ha'aretz, or if you're guest of an Am Ha'aretz. So the Chachamim replied back, "Amru so somebody's not careful about their own kashrus, so how can they be trusted in other situations? The way this plays out halachically, this is again a specific situation in demai, but the way it gets applied more broadly, Rambam writes in source 13, "Amitarech somebody who is hosted by a homeowner, yayin basar dag, and they serve wine or meat or cheese or fish. So all these things have potential kashrut issues. So mutter, how is a mutter? It's permissible to eat from this person. If you're eating by a regular Jew and they serve you meat or wine or cheese, whatever, it's fine. We don't have to shalala. You don't have to ask. You don't have to start interrogating. That's what we were saying before. That's what it means to be enach mamisurin, is that you don't have to start interrogating. You don't have to check all the receipts and all the packaging and all and the like. And this is true. Afa pishi enam akir. This is true. Even if you don't know that person, el yodesho yudi bilvad. As long as you know that person is Jewish and they seem like a normal mainstream Jew for these purposes. However, so somebody who is known to not keep kosher, is not careful about their kashrut, so then you shouldn't stay with them. And here the assumption is not just that you're sleeping in there going out to eat, but that you're sleeping, you're being served by the person. If you do stay with them, you can't eat their meat, you can't drink their wine. Unless somebody else can corroborate that that what they're serving is actually proper, but you can't rely on that person on their own. So according to the Rambam, it's somebody who we specifically know does not keep kosher, then you can't trust them. The Shulchan Aruch gives a subtly different, but very importantly different formulation of this in source 14 on page 320. He says, "Hachashud lechol dvarim ha'asurim." Somebody who is suspected of eating things that are prohibited, doesn't matter whether it's a Torah prohibition or rabbinic prohibition. Prohibition in the smoke Allah, you can't rely on him for those kinds of things. So Shulchan Aruch, so now the bar is different, right? With the Rambam said that in order to then be able to eat with them, it has to be sort of established, it has to be known that that person isn't keeping proper kashrus. According to Shulchan Aruch, it's merely if we suspect that they don't keep kashrus. And I don't think that this is just like I don't know them, so therefore I suspect them, but we have a reason to be a little bit suspicious. Significantly, the Shulchan Aruch says specifically, it's specifically things that they're suspicious about, that they're suspect about, that you're not allowed to eat. And that's sort of important. So Shach clarifies that even here, it's only when bi'adua shu chashi, right? When we know that there's a reason to be suspicious. A regular Jew who, you know, without any reason to be suspicious, you're allowed to eat even, you know, even with out of concerns or basar b'chalav, even if you're concerned, you know, we don't have to worry about the shechita. Everything is a fine. The Ramah gives even more stringent stance though in source 16. He says, "Ish amrim afilu mimisha eino chashud rakshe ein makiri no toshu mutzai b'kashu." So Rambam said you have to know that they don't keep kosher. Shulchan Aruch says maybe you suspect, you have reason to suspect that they don't keep kosher. Rabbah says that you can only eat with them if you know that they actually keep proper kashers. And that's specifically with, when it comes to wine or other things where you have to be concerned about. With that said, if you're sleeping at that person's place, if you're lodging there, then you can eat with them, but you have to be careful about the things that one might be suspicious about. So based on this, the Taz says something goes, again, even beyond what I might have assumed. The Taz says in source 17 that applies even to things that are otherwise permitted. If I go to the home of somebody who doesn't keep kosher, but there's something that has OU packaging on it, so according to the Taz, it seems like even the thing that has the OU on it, I shouldn't eat. Or maybe, or you could read it differently, that you could be talking about, you know, something that's relatively neutral. So even fruit, for example, you shouldn't eat from that person. That's what it seems like it's saying. And the concern is, because I think actually both of these are correct, because Shema Yachilen Dvarim Ha'asurim Gamken, because it's not about those items. It's that I'm concerned that if I eat some of the permitted things, then they might also feed me something that's prohibited without my realizing it. So that has important implications, especially for people who, friends and relatives who are observant. So that, and this is not the final word, but that would have important implications that according to the Taz, it's not just that you can't eat their meat, but you can't even eat the things that would otherwise be prohibited. So based on this, Rav Shmuel Vosner, the Sheir HaLevi, it was a posik in Bnei Brak, passed away about 10 years ago. So he says, L'chakhila shouldn't stay with somebody and eat with them. It's not so clear here what specific, I think he's talking about someone who's chashid, right? Somebody who, I don't know how good the kashrus is, so ideally shouldn't stay with them and eat with them, even things that are permitted, because maybe you have to be concerned that they'll feed other things that are problematic. But there's a difference. There's an additional lacha that im avra al zeb yizarech etzla, loy tzvichu levata harachaso el yochal havada emetze. But if I do end up staying with somebody who I'm not so sure about, so the things that are permitted, the things that are permitted to eat, I am allowed to eat. So ideally, you shouldn't, lodge by that person and eat their food. But if you already sort of booked the reservation, you already made the arrangements, whatever it is, so then you're allowed to eat the things that would be clearly permitted. So that's what Rav Vosner says here. So, but with that said, something that, again, we've sort of formulated, but something that's stated very clearly on page 322, source 19, the Chalkas Binyamin. This is Rav Binyamin Cohen, who is the son of Revival Cohen, Zichron of the Rach, who passed away this past year. Revival Cohen was the author of the Badei HaShulchan, which is sort of the Mishnah Brura on Basar B'chalav, on meat and dairy, and Staka, and Avelis. So his son, Rav Binyamin Cohen, sort of continued that work on other areas of Halacha. So he says here, "Ein hakavana d'v'inan shehei yarei elokim marbim uchasid v'tzadik." So it's not that Maybe I'll be mechazev and tzaddik. So it's not that, again, when we talk about whether or not I'm able to eat in someone's home, and we gave different standards of whether I absolutely know that the kashrus absolutely can't be trusted, or whether I just happen to not know them, so I shouldn't trust them. The Chalkos Begamin is very clear that in order to trust someone, it's not that they have to be the biggest Talmud Chacham. It doesn't mean they have to be the most righteous person in the world. Somebody who davens and puts on talis and tefillin, somebody who washes their hands before they eat, so anybody who's observant on a very normal, basic level, right, average person who in that sense, so you can eat in their home. It's very interesting the discussion that goes on, and sort of an ongoing discussion that never really has an ending point among rabbis, is whether rabbis should eat in the homes of their congregants or not. So some rabbis don't want to, because maybe if there's some people in their community that they're not so sure, again, that they're in the chashid category, that not that it's clear that they'll serve treif, but don't really know exactly how careful they're being. Some rabbis, you know, want to stay away from that, and then they say, well, I don't want to, you know, eat at this person's house and not that person's house, so then they don't eat in anybody's home altogether. Some might allow it if it's catered, and that's a sort of a separate discussion. A Mayan, thank God, in this community, I feel that I trust everybody who I'm invited to. Everybody in our community most people falls into this category of Chagas Ben Yamin, people who are observant Jews. And that's what you require. Again, you don't have to be any sort of super anything in order to be trusted in a kashrus, in order for somebody to eat in your home. Any questions up until this point?
I have a question.
I do too. Okay. Go ahead, Tony.
Tony, go ahead.
It sounds like an oversimplification to say that if you're eating in the non-Jew's house, that you can eat everything but meat and wine, because I don't think that's what any of us would really feel comfortable with. I mean, cooked foods, if somebody's making me scrambled eggs, do I feel comfortable eating that?
I think, practically speaking, you're right, and I think that's sort of what Taz is saying also. If we're talking about fruit, so the Taz's concern is that they might feed you, you know, if they give you the fruit, they might give you something else. But with cooked food, I think you might be correct that depending on what the level of suspicion is, that you might not want to eat anything that's cooked.
Right.
I think that's a reasonable, that's definitely a reasonable thing to, Gloria.
Yeah, going along like the non-religious Jew, what if you don't plan to eat any of their food and just they understand you're bringing all of your own food? Is that a problem to? Yes, they know that you keep kosher and you just are going to be staying there, you know, sleeping there. Is that a problem to bring
yeah,
your
I,
own
I think
food?
I think the assumption here when we talked about staying with somebody was that they're feeding you also, which in certain, you know, in a time period where you don't necessarily have restaurants to go out to, where it might not have been so simple to bring your own food. So, you know, it could be that if you're staying somewhere, that means you have to eat there also. Obviously, I think if you're just sleeping there, if you're just using their beds, but you're not actually eating there, so that's obviously not going to be a problem.
Well, you could be eating there, but you would be eating on your own plates or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So when it comes to non-observant relatives or friends, so Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva on page 323. Obviously, not going to read the whole thing, especially out of time considerations. But he says that, so he was asked this, he was actually asked this question in Moscow, when he was living in Moscow. He was living in Russia. So he had, you know, balabatim who were observant, but their children were not so observant. And sometimes these people, you know, relied on, you know, need to be able to rely on their children being able to cook for them. And what can they do? So he said that you should, have a general sense, should test them or find some way to kind of get an understanding. If it's, clear that they care about you and they're going to be honest and they're not going to mislead you in any way. And they say we're going to only cook you kosher food, and you know that they're actually only going to do that. Then he says that that's acceptable. His caveat is, in a situation where it's really necessary when someone's weak, it could be that this would be extended to also extremely close relatives. So that kind of permission for Ramosha is only allowed under very sort of tight circumstances. But that's obviously very important that if somebody's very clear, if you have a very clear sense that that they're not going to lie to you, then that's fine. Ramosha Sternbach suggests in source 21, let's say it's for the opposite situation. You have a father who's not observant and sons of Baal Tshuva, and they want to eat in the father in their parents' home. So he gives a couple of solutions. One is that if you're talking about meat, especially, so check the packages. The packages are acceptable. So then you're fine. Since you can also rely on the Ramosha approach, that that you have sort of a clear sense that that you're not going to be misled. So those are a couple of possibilities there. Fine. Rav Eliezer Melamed in the Pnimei Halacha says that that if you're staying in somebody's home, or let's say you're being hosted by somebody and they don't keep kosher, but they'll bring in food from a kosher restaurant, a kosher caterer, so they're allowed to heat it in the oven as long as it's wrapped. Or if you put it in the microwave, wrapped with plastic and the oven's wrapped in aluminum foil, so there you can have even if they didn't kosher their oven, they can cook, they can heat food for you that way. On page 326, Dei Chamed and Sefer Kashrus talk about lying in a certain sense. So let's say you're going to be somewhere you're really not comfortable eating there, so you don't have to say that I'm not eating there because I don't trust your kashrus. You can say that either because I don't like this food, I'm on the diet, or I don't I don't eat out in general. Or if it's talking about going out to a restaurant and you're not sure about that restaurant, you can say I'm saving money and not going out. Whatever it is that you have to do. At the end of this shiur, they tell a story of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was, I think, with relatives for Pesach. He wasn't really so keen on their or just a family, he wasn't keen on their Pesach kashrus. So he said to them, I don't eat kibbutz, and that was kind of his way of getting out of eating anything at all. But then for the rest of his life, he kept by kibbutz. So his original custom was not to limit himself to non-kibbutz, but he took that on. Here's a similar story of Rav Heschel Schechter also, that that one time he was in Israel, he was staying with relatives, and in Israel you have to be concerned about separating truma and maaser. So when it comes to sugar, sugar is produce, so that requires separating trumos and maaseros. So he was served tea and asked if he wants sugar with it. Well, he wasn't sure if they separated trumos and maaseros from the sugar, so he said, I don't have sugar with my tea. So for the last 50 years since then, he doesn't have sugar with his tea because that's what he said back then. So that's a very high level of integrity. On the one hand, being Mishana and Mipnei Darkei Shalom, but at the same time, a high level of integrity. When it comes to eating in the home of people with different practices, some people have different levels of kashrus, all of which are valid, but maybe different stringencies and the like. So they invoke here the Mishnah and Gemaros, the Mishnah and Yevamos, or Gemara and Yevamos, that Meshama had different standards when it came to marriage, and permitted relationships, and nonetheless, they didn't suspect, each other, daughters and sons to be mamzerim and or the like, and they allowed each other to marry each other. So that's sort of a model for being able to hold by different standards for yourself, and yet to be able to navigate with others. So the Ramah says in source 27, Misha noeg be'ez davar is mikoach shesover shedina hu hachi. Somebody who holds something's prohibited because he thinks that's halacha or because of a chumrah that he takes on for himself. So he's allowed to eat with others who don't necessarily hold by that chumrah. So Rav Yosef Sfirimon explains that, on the one hand, if you're hosting somebody and you know that they, are careful about Chol Yisrael, or they're careful about a certain standard of Shemitah, so you should try to meet their standard, just like you wouldn't serve vegetarian meat. So you should try to meet the standard that person holds of kashrus if it's something that's obvious. But that doesn't mean that, if I hold a different standard of kashrus, so I can, I can eat from their other people's dishes, and the like. Eliezer Melamed says that certain things shouldn't compromise on. So when it comes to, let's say, kinyos, for example, you can't say, well, I'm eating at a Sfaradi person's house. So, when he has a Sfaradi person's house, I don't keep kinyos. When I'm at home, I keep kinyos. So, certain things like that, Kol Yisrael, black kosher with meat. So, some of those, mainstream things that, sort of a whole group of people hold by. So, there maybe shouldn't compromise. But otherwise, if it's little other things, they have a different, when we talk about the whether or not you have to have two separate ovens and how long you have to wait in between. So, those kinds of things, maybe there's room to rely on other people's standards, even if it's not your own. The book goes on to discuss the necessity for hashkacha. The point there basically is that when it comes to A, that there's money involved, and B, the complication of artificial ingredients and the like, and the scale of production and the like. So, it's one thing to say edecha ne'eman bisurin when it comes to eating in somebody's home, and things are very simple. When it comes to relying on a kashrus agency and there's money involved and the like, so that's why we have to be a little bit more careful. On page 334, they give some basic standards for hashgachos. Better to rely on well-known organizations and individual rabbis. That's become a very big issue in certain places where everybody puts the title rabbi in front of their name and opens a hashgacha and the like. So that's something to be careful about, depending on the situation. But so some of those guidelines are there. They're good to take note of. And the last thing that gets discussed here, and we're running out of time, so that's why I'm sort of rushing, but I think these points can really be summarized generally. And the last thing they discuss is whether you're allowed to enter a non-kosher restaurant and eat something that's permitted there. So the Gemara Masechet Shabbos talks about the issue of Maris Ayin. If somebody's clothes are wet, you fall into a puddle or something, fall into a river, and you want your clothes to dry, you want to put them out, so you have to do it in a way that people aren't going to think that you were doing laundry on Shabbos. So with kashrus also, you have to be careful about Maris Ayin. So Moshe says, let's say, you're on the road and you're absolutely starving, there's nothing to eat. So in that case, as long as there's nobody around who would sort of be suspicious, so then if you go into a non-kosher place and you can get something that is absolutely fine, so then it would be permitted to go in there and eat there. But otherwise, if you're in sort of like, a firm neighborhood and you walk into the McDonald's, so that could become a little bit problematic. So that's something to be careful about as well. So there are some very basic issues when it comes to credibility, nemanus in kashrus. And again, hopefully our goal is to be able to, for people who host, to be able to accommodate as many people as possible. But at the end of the day, we have guidelines for when people are not so observant, but certainly among, our own community where, we trust that people who are Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus. So that's what you really need to know in order to be able to eat at someone's home. It doesn't have to get so much more complicated than that. But thanks, everyone. I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.